I'm Bruce Barber, and in this week's Yale Cancer Center Answers, our hosts Dr. Edward Chu and Dr. Ken Miller will discuss the treatment of brain tumors. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and a leading expert in cancer drug development. Dr. Miller, a medical oncologist, is the director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Clinic at Yale Cancer Center and specializes in pain and palliative care. Yale Cancer Center Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date cancer information every Sunday evening on WNPR. Doctors Chu and Miller welcome some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. They want to provide you with help and hope from Yale Cancer Center, and they're also available to answer your questions. If you'd like to submit a question about cancer to the show, please email them to canceranswers@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC, and they'll answer your question on the air in a future broadcast. Now, if you're interested in listening to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers, or if you'd like to learn more about a specific kind of cancer, all of the shows are posted in audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website. You'll find that at yalecancercenter.org. This evening, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will discuss brain cancer. Each year, over 17,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with primary brain tumors. Our goal is to give you information on the detection, diagnosis, and treatment of brain cancer. Good evening, doctors.
Hello, Bruce. I'm Dr. Ed Chu.
And I'm Dr. Ken Miller.
Today, Ken and I are joined by our colleague, Dr. Joachim Behring, Assistant Professor of Neurology and Medical Oncology here at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Behring directs the brain tumor program here at the Yale Cancer Center and is a leading expert in this field. Joachim, thanks so much for being with us tonight on Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you for the invitation.
Joachim, let's begin by talking about the different types of tumors that can develop in the brain, both benign and malignant.
Generally, there are two major groups of brain cancer, the primary brain cancer and what you consider metastatic or secondary brain cancer. Today, we'll mostly focus on the former group, the primary brain tumors. They, again, are divided in tumors that are derived from cells that are called glial cells, and the tumors are referred to as gliomas, and then tumors that are less common derived from nerve cells. The most common tumor amongst all of these is a tumor called glioblastoma multiforme, and at the same time, unfortunately, it's also the most malignant type of brain cancer.
Now, Joachim, also, is there not a difference in the type of brain cancers depending upon the age of the patient?
Well, in general, as for so many other types of cancer, brain cancer is usually a disease of the elderly. However, they are age-specific entities. The tumor that I just mentioned, glioblastoma multiforme, is a lot more common in the elderly population, and that means in patients above the age of 65, as opposed to other tumors that are a lot more common in childhood, such as medulloblastoma and related cancers.
What are the risk factors? I've heard people talk about cell phones being an issue or high-tension power lines. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
To this day, there's really no reliable population-based study that establishes a link between an environmental exposure, such as the ones you just mentioned, or certain toxins to brain cancer. Probably the only known link is exposure to high doses of radiation, but this only really occurs probably in the setting of an industrial accident or something like that. There are multiple studies now available that try to see if there's a correlation between cell phone use and primary brain tumors, and the vast majority of these studies do not point to a link. There are a few where a link was suggested, but to this day, there is no clear established link between cell phone use and brain cancer. There has been no dramatic increase since cell phone use has become more common.
Is there any relationship with genetics and the development of brain cancer?
Very few cases of brain cancer can be linked to a hereditary predisposition to cancer. I would think it's in the order of less than 2 or 3%.
What are the signs and symptoms of a brain tumor, and what would be reasons that you would suggest someone goes to see their doctor?
The early signs of a brain tumor are rather nonspecific. There's not really one sign that would immediately lead to the suspicion of a brain tumor. Most types of brain cancer actually present with one of two symptoms, a headache or a seizure. Now, the latter one is a lot more dramatic, and patients immediately go to seek medical attention. With a headache, obviously, that is one of the most common complaints that patients go to see their doctor for. That is a little more difficult. I think a headache that is new, that arises without any clear factor, such as a lot of stress or a head or neck injury, a headache that gets worse and worse week after week, that should get the patient's attention and then lead to a consultation with their family physician.
And just looking at it the other way around, for when people have headaches and go to see, let's say, a neurologist, I mean, of all that group of patients who go, how often do you find a brain tumor as opposed to just other causes?
It's exceedingly rare. Okay. The most common types of headache are the tension-type headache, migraine, cluster headaches. Of all patients who present to a neurologist's office with a headache, a minute fraction, maybe less than 1%, will end up having a brain tumor.
So again, the typical approach would be if someone has a headache that doesn't, you know, resolve with the typical aspirin or Tylenol, then that individual might seek attention first from their family care physician, and then if there was concern at that point, then to refer to someone like yourself for further evaluation.
Right. I think that would be the most reasonable approach. It depends a little bit on how ill the patient is. Obviously, sometimes patients present with a disabling headache, and patients with a brain tumor can have a bleed in their brain into the tumor, and those patients present a lot more dramatic, and they probably best go to the emergency room right away. But in general, patients are referred to me through a local family physician or a general neurologist who think that what they're facing is beyond the typical everyday headache patient.
Now, there's a lot of different forms of X-rays and imaging, CAT scans, PET scans, MRIs. Can you tell us a little bit about how you use those in terms of diagnosing a brain tumor and then looking at the response to treatment?
Once there's a strong suspicion for a brain tumor, the most sensitive, non-invasive test is a magnetic resonance imaging, an MRI. And in many cases, that is the first step. A CAT scan is really more of an emergency room tool, or it's a diagnostic tool for patients who, for some reason, cannot have an MRI, such as patients who have a cardiac pacemaker. But the MRI really gives us the first clue as to what the origin of the headache might be and if there's concern for a tumor or not.
Now, Joachim, one of the issues with MRIs, and I have to say I didn't quite appreciate this until I myself had to undergo an MRI, is the tight quarters in which the test is being done. And so what do you suggest in patients who are perhaps claustrophobic and who may have difficulties in tight quarters?
Patients who are claustrophobic, many of them actually still tolerate to go into the MRI as long as they're premedicated. There are sedatives like lorazepam, just to mention one, that can be taken within half an hour of the examination, and then patients can rest or even sleep during the examination. Patients who, even with that, cannot go into a closed MRI scan can undergo an open MRI scan. That is a lot more convenient and not as much anxiety provoking. And for many indications, although the image quality is not as high as with the closed MRI, it's still sufficient to rule out the possibility of a brain tumor.
And Ken had just mentioned a little while ago the use of PET to try to image the brain. What are your thoughts? Well, maybe first for our listeners out there, maybe you could explain what a PET scan is and then how you view where the PET scans would fit into the diagnosis of brain tumors.
PET stands for positron emission tomography. For the patient, it is a rather similar procedure to MRI in that the imaging device is rather similar and a contrast is administered. As opposed to MRI, which really gives you an accurate anatomical picture, PET scanning is a metabolic picture of the brain. It has a lower resolution, but areas that are particularly active, that have a high demand for metabolic substrates, such as brain tumors, can light up on a PET scan. The problem with PET scanning is that it's not very sensitive. That means a large number of patients with brain cancer have a negative PET scan. And having said that, patients with low-grade brain tumors do not benefit from a PET scan because these tumors generally do not take up the tracer. So I look at it as a test that is useful in specific indications. After exposure to radiation, sometimes the question arises whether a change on an MRI scan reflects growing tumor or the effects of radiation. And in that scenario, PET scan can many times help to distinguish the two conditions.
Now, if someone goes to the doctor and they have having headaches and they're the small group of patients who have a brain tumor, what happens next in terms of making a diagnosis and then the first step in terms of treatment?
Well, although MRI scan really is very good in detecting tumors, the vast majority of patients will require confirmation by retrieving a tissue specimen off the mass by a neurosurgeon. And many times the first this last diagnostic step is also the first therapeutic step. Many patients with a tumor that is considered resectable, that can be removed at least in part by the neurosurgeon, will have that procedure performed, and then the pathologist takes a piece of that mass to identify the subtype of brain cancer. If the cancer is located in an area where surgery, major surgery, would result in patient's disability, then the procedure is limited to a stereotactic biopsy, which is a lot less invasive and only serves the purpose of making a specific diagnosis.
Joachim, you and Dr. Pietmeyer are the directors of the Brain Tumor Center here at Yale. Maybe you can explain for our listeners what that means, and you know when would an individual be referred to your center?
We have established a multidisciplinary brain cancer center at Yale, and Dr. Pietmeyer and I are only two of many members involved in this endeavor. We have radiation oncologists at Yale, neuroradiologists who are specialized in the diagnosis of brain cancer. We have neuropathologists. We have obviously a lot of administrative support. We have a clinical coordinator, Betsy DeAndrea, who is the first contact point and who makes the decision or helps with the decision which member of this multidisciplinary operation a patient should be referred to first. Those are the major components. We meet weekly on a weekly basis and review the cases of the week in order to establish a diagnostic and treatment plan for these patients. We evaluate patients for their eligibility for our clinical trials. This weekly meeting also serves as a platform discussions with the basic scientists at Yale who are interested in brain cancer.
You know, along those lines, what's the value of a second opinion? I mean, if someone has a biopsy and they're told they have a tumor, a brain tumor, what role do second opinions have?
I think second opinions can be very helpful under various circumstances. Sometimes you encounter a case that's truly challenging, an exceedingly rare tumor, a tumor that in spite of all efforts is still undiagnosed as to the exact subcategory, and then sometimes a second opinion is helpful to the medical team. Many times a second opinion is very helpful to the patient. They're facing a diagnosis with a rare disease. They're facing a disorder with a rather poor prognosis, and obtaining a second opinion will inform them as to how other multidisciplinary centers would approach the case, what clinical trials might be available at other institutions. I think obtaining a second opinion at a referral center, at a multidisciplinary center, is crucial. We are dealing with a disease that is where only 20,000 cases a year in total are encountered in the U.S., I strongly believe that patients benefit considerably from the input of specialists in multiple fields then after discussion of the diagnostic material come up with a treatment plan.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to us and to Dr. Behring at canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about the treatment of brain tumors with Dr. Joachim Behring from the Yale Cancer Center.
This is a medical minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. Breast cancer is the second most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2007, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Now, women should schedule an annual mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers such as the Yale Cancer Center to make innovative new treatments which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration available to patients. For more information, visit www.yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. Joachim Behring from the Yale Cancer Center, who is one of the directors of the Brain Tumor Center. Joachim, let's start this second portion of the program by talking about treatment for brain tumors. I mean, what are some of the surgical options for someone who's found to have a glioblastoma that you were telling us about?
The first step of therapy is indeed surgical intervention in the vast majority of patients. The goal of surgery is to remove as much of the tumor as possible. However, patients should not be put at risk of suffering neurological disability as a result of the procedure. We know that we cannot cure glioblastoma multiforme surgically, so there is no benefit to the patient if one tries to be overly aggressive. Relieving the mass effect that the tumor exerts on the normal brain frequently results in complete resolution of the patient's symptoms. So that is the rationale for trying to take out as much as possible.
Now, you know, Joachim, obviously there are a lot of very vital pathways and structures in the brain. So how does the neurosurgeon know that when he or she is going in to resect that, normal brain tissues may not be involved and then obviously have, consequences after the surgery?
Yeah, there are now numerous tools available to the neurosurgeon to plan the surgical procedure ahead of time. And most of these are imaging procedures that can be done while the patient is prepared for surgery. Just to mention a few functional MRI scan or a procedure, also MRI-based, that's called fiber tracking MRI. Tell the surgeon where functionally important areas of the brain are, such as language, and also can point out the connections of these functionally important centers on the surface of the brain with deeper structures and their relationship to the tumor. And then the surgeon in the operating room can use a procedure called electrical stimulation, where an electrode is put on the surface of the brain to then get a better feeling for where important areas are located.
I want to ask you some about the terminology. There's talk about gamma knife, cyber knife. What are those?
These are all new treatment modalities that have become available over the past 10 years. And the terminology implies that it's a surgical procedure, but it's actually not.
Mm-hmm.
Both gamma knife and cyber knife are primarily radiation therapies. Gamma knife is a procedure where the patient's head is placed into a large shielding device that contains a large number of burr holes. Outside of that shielding device is a radiation source. These burr holes can be directed towards the target within the brain, let's say a deep-seated brain tumor. And the major advantage of this technique is that by having the radiation beam come from multiple directions, the normal brain surrounding this lesion can be spared. a lot more than with the conventional radiation treatment modalities. Gamma knife requires a small surgical procedure. A head frame has to be fixed to the patient's head, which facilitates planning, or it's actually crucial for planning and targeting of the lesion. That is done under local anesthesia, though, and is minimal. CyberKnife is quite similar in that it also delivers a focused beam of radiation to a specific target, such as a brain cancer. The difference is that this head frame is not necessary. Plain X-rays help the radiation therapist to target the X-ray beam to the intended lesion. Also, CyberKnife is not only applicable to brain cancer, it can be used for cancer anywhere in the body.
And Joachim, we presently have a Gamma Knife facility here at Yale, is that right?
Yes, we do.
And we don't yet have, but we're about to have a CyberKnife system in
place
here?
We will have a system for what you call image-guided stereotactic radiosurgery here soon, and we're quite excited about it. I think it will be a tool that will be frequently used for various types of cancer, and especially for our neuro-oncology program. It'll enable us to provide stereotactic focused radiosurgery to spine cancer.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now after surgery, what's the role of chemotherapy in the treatment of brain tumors?
It depends a little bit on the type of brain cancer that you're facing, but let's again focus on the most common type of brain cancer, which is glioblastoma. A clinical trial was conducted and published about a year ago. It was a combined effort of neuro-oncology centers around the world, which firmly established the role of chemotherapy after the use of a tumor resection. It's been shown that chemotherapy with an alkylating agent called temozolomide provided along with radiation therapy and followed thereafter increases survival of patients with glioblastoma multiforme. There are other types of brain cancer where chemotherapy is really the first treatment of choice, such as a cancer called lymphoma of the brain.
You know, I want to ask you that, because I know you're an expert in the treatment of lymphoma of the brain. In that case, is surgery the primary treatment, or is chemotherapy the primary treatment?
It's really chemotherapy. The surgery is limited to a stereotactic biopsy. Lymphoma of the brain is an elusive target. This is not a single tumor. It is composed of lymphocytes. These are cells that of the immune system that are supposed to traffic the entire body to eliminate agents or invaders such as bacteria that don't belong there. And the tumors reflect that behavior. They migrate throughout the nervous system. So resecting a lymphoma would not really make much sense. And many times, or in the vast majority of patients, surgery is limited to a biopsy. And then the primary treatment modality is chemotherapy.
I have to say, I've been very excited, and having read about some of your work and seen some of your patients, but, I mean, how effective chemotherapy can be for some of them.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Lymphoma is a very sensitive, chemosensitive tumor.
Just along those lines, for the primary CNS lymphoma, which we're talking about, is there a particular age group in which you see this cancer in the brain?
Again, like with glioblastoma, it is usually a disease of the elderly. Most patients are actually older than 60 years of age. However, in a referral center like Yale, we certainly see patients almost at any age group, from the pediatric age group to 60 and above.
And for this type of brain cancer, are there any kind of specific risk factors that one can attribute to the disease?
There are actually the risk of suffering brain lymphoma is markedly increased in patients whose immune system is compromised. May that be through an infection like the HIV virus, may that be through pharmacotherapy such as chronic use of steroids.
Mm-hmm. For in terms of treatment, there was talk, and I think there's use of a device that actually can be put right on the tumor or right in the brain that releases chemotherapy. Can you tell us some about that?
Are you referring to the wafer?
The wafer,
treatments? Yeah. Yeah. There are wafers available that are impregnated with a chemotherapeutic agent, and they have added this treatment modality to what a neurosurgeon can provide in terms of treatment for patients with malignant gliomas. It is also an FDA-approved form of therapy for both the initial diagnosis and relapse disease. These chemotherapy impregnated wafers are placed into the wall of the resection cavity. They are about the size of a dime and very thin, the surgeon attaches these wafers after resecting the tumor to the wall of the brain tissue that's left behind. Then over the next few days after surgery, the chemotherapeutic agent is released from the wafer and diffuses into the brain. It has shown to be effective and is certainly a reasonable form of therapy. It is not the cure for glioblastoma, which we unfortunately don't have, but it is one option that belongs to our armamentarium.
Joachim, you are playing a very active role in developing new clinical trials here at the Cancer Center. Maybe you can kind of quickly review with us some of the interesting studies that you're involved with.
Yeah, we've been involved in a large number of clinical trials, and we'll open a large number in the near future. What we currently have available is a clinical trial that uses the standard of care, which, as we discussed, is a combination of radiation therapy and chemotherapy, with a form of therapy where the dose of the chemotherapy is escalated or intensified. Over the next couple of weeks, we will have a trial available where the standard of care, again, radiation and chemotherapy, is combined with a tumor-directed vaccine. The vaccine mounts an immune response targeting a certain receptor on the surface of glioblastoma cells, and we're very excited about that clinical trial, too. We'll also open a clinical trial that uses an agent targeting blood vessel growth within the tumor. We had been involved in a trial where a new compound was administered directly into the brain through infusion. That trial has been completed, and we're awaiting the publication of the results.
Well, if you have questions for Dr. Behring and questions or for Dr. Ed Chu or myself, we encourage you to go to our website, which is yalecancercenter.org, for more information about cancer and the resources available to you. Again, you can listen to past editions of the Yale Cancer Center Answers in audio and written format on the Yale Cancer Center website, which is www.yalecancercenter.org. Joachim, I want to thank you for being on the show and for telling us about some of the very exciting advances in terms of treatment of brain tumors.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you on a future show to tell us the results of your very interesting clinical trials. And remember, tune into WNPR every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. for Yale Cancer Center Answers for the latest information in cancer care and treatment. Our next program will feature a discussion of sarcoma with Dr. Gary Friedlander. Until then, this is Dr. Ed Chu
and Dr. Ken Miller
from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
Thank you, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller. If you have questions for Dr. Behring, I encourage you to go to yalecancercenter.org for more information about cancer and the resources available to you. You can also listen to past editions of Yale Cancer Center Answers in audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website at yalecancercenter.org. Remember, tune in to WNPR every Sunday evening at 6 for Yale Cancer Center Answers for the latest information in cancer care and treatment. On next week's show, Dr. Chu and Dr. Miller will discuss screening, detection, and treatment of colorectal cancer.